Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Shout out to all you dunkers once again for embracing your bounce. Second round of the playoffs are underway, and this is where the real fun starts. I don't even have a joke intro. I don't have anything. I'm ready to get down to business. What a basketball weekend that was.
Oh, there we go. We are cutting straight to the chase on this episode of The Dunker Spot. I respect it. It was a basketball-heavy weekend. We had some series in. The second round is officially underway now. Before we dig into some of the second-round matchups, let's say goodbye very quickly. The Grizzlies were able to knock off the Timberwolves over the weekend. I just want to give some love to the Timberwolves for the year they had. From where they were last year, the strides they made in the second half of the year after they made their coaching change, for them to get the buy-in that they got from D'Angelo Russell, from Karl-Anthony Towns, the step that Anthony Edwards was able to take this year, the flying around of Jared Vanderbilt, the steps that Jaden McDaniels took this year, and we saw him make some big plays throughout this postseason for the Timberwolves. I certainly understand the frustration surrounding the team, considering they blew, what, 3 double-digit leads in this series. Like, they very well could have won it if they were able to slam the door. But don't let that disappointment overshadow what they were able to accomplish this season. Like, a 7th seed in the year they had is pretty darn impressive.
No, I mean, you have to learn to win at a high level in this league. And unfortunately for Minnesota, their lesson was a little bit harder than they probably would have liked to take. But they pushed. They had a great season. A lot of the questions that I know I was tough on Minnesota that I may have had coming into the season got answered. Their defense held up. To be able to execute that defensive game plan against Memphis consistently over 6 games impressed me. You know, I thought Cat took strides defensively. He was a big question mark. And now you see he was able to consistently be at the level and not be a liability in the playoffs. That's a plus. Anthony Edwards showed growth as far as scoring the basketball, as far as, hey, being someone who could take on a one-on-one matchup on ball. May not be as happy about the off-ball stuff sometimes, but you know you can put him on someone, he gets juiced up. D'Angelo Russell was a big part of the buy-in. Patrick Beverly had an impact on the Minnesota Timberwolves
season. An impact on the Minnesota Timberwolves. I'm sorry, continue.
And then you found the player Vanderbilt, McDaniels, Jordan McLaughlin. You found pieces. So you found something, and now you can build on it. That's always what you want to do as a young team. So salute to the Timberwolves. I'm very interested to see what their next move is going to be because, again, this still is the West. And as great of a year as they had, you have to now do it again. And teams aren't going to be surprised this time. Mm-hmm. You're on teams' radars. And so you have to be able to take this and build on it and have the buy-in and maintain it and put the same effort that you did in climbing up there because the teams behind you are going to be chasing you. And so you may not be going from the hunter to the hunted, but there are some teams who wish they could have had this season and they're mm-hmm. going to look to work to take it from you. So I'm interested to see what Minnesota does next.
I too am intrigued by what Minnesota does next. Like, the one thing you bank on, I think, for Minnesota is the internal development. Since their core is as young as it is, what we saw from Anthony Edwards in year one to year two was a pretty seismic jump. And I would imagine after an offseason, another offseason plus this postseason experience, I think he's going to come back looking like an entirely different dude next year. That should be fun. We saw some growth from Cat, as you mentioned, on the defensive end, even offensively. He took some strides as a driver that, like, he had it in the bag, but he didn't have it in the bag like this. And we saw some of those drives open up. It's something that you touched on many times on the podcast and during some of the watch parties that we held during the series. Memphis tried with Xavier Tillman to kind of show and recover on some of those pick and pops. And Cat burned them consistently with drives. So I'm ready to see how he adds to the offensive repertoire as well. The big question mark is going to be D'Angelo Russell. Don't anticipate the Wolves being a big free agency player this year, just in terms of their salary sheet. Russell seems to be like an interesting intersection because of one, he's good. He is also important. Also, he's very costly and he has 1 year left on the deal. And it's going to boil down to how Minnesota wants to shape this thing around Cat and Anthony Edwards moving forward. And if they do want to size up, then maybe you shift more of the ball handling to Edwards. And now where does that leave Russell? Mark Stein in his newsletter said from some rival execs that D'Angelo Russell, they expect Russell to at least come up in trade talks, if not moved altogether. If you're Minnesota, would you look to move him, or do you think he should be part of the core long term?
I mean, for the right deal, I would understand if they did it. I don't necessarily think you have to make a move right now. The optics, obviously, where he didn't necessarily finish that game make it look a certain way. But I think he's part of what you built with Anthony Edwards and Cat. He held up his end of the bargain defensively. You've seen that these three can work together, probably maybe to a higher degree than you may have thought. So I think you may look to ride that out and see if you can add to it and make that better before you go ahead and make the move. So I don't think he's untouchable, but I don't think it's just going to be something they do just to do.
I got you. I think finding a deal from him will be, I don't want to say difficult, because again, he is young and talented, but it's going to take the right guy. Like, I think if you're moving Edwards, I mean, if you're moving Russell, it's going to be for a 3D+ type wing, just so you can size up a little bit more. And I don't know how many teams have that guy willing to just be poached. And I don't know how many teams have that guy that, and they're also willing to move him for like a point guard. Like, trying to find that blend is going to be a little bit difficult. So I guess we'll just have to see what happens there. But again, kudos to the Wolves for the series that they had and the year that they had. And now we get to Utah, who is also on the couch. 1-2-3 Cancun. The Mavericks were able to send them home. I wish I could be nicer to the Utah Jazz in the way that they bowed out. I can't be, honestly. It was a disappointing end to their season. Things kind of tailed off in the second half of the year for them. And now we're back to more Donovan Mitchell rumblings, Rudy Gobert rumblings, Quinn Snyder rumblings. And so for you, what is the first thing you address if you're the Utah Jazz?
The first thing you have to address is which one of these two guys are we going to keep? Unfortunately, it's gotten to that point. There's been too many disappointments. There's been too much discord. There's no real coming back. So you got to choose, hey, are we sticking with Rudy and see what we can get for Donovan, or are we stick with Donovan and see what we can get for Rudy? It's not going to work. Even if it's, there's no ultimatum, if there is an ultimatum, whatever it is, you can't bring them both back based on what we just saw. And you have to find a way to build a dynamic, because here's the tough part, right? Utah had a heck of a run last season. Unbelievable run, fell short. They tried to correct maybe a little bit too much. Maybe the offense slowed down a little bit too much. Maybe they didn't fix some of the defensive tweaks. Maybe they assumed some things would carry over. And you could tell as the season wore on, obviously they had their injury issues, but some of the things didn't work. Now the league just kind of had a book on, hey, this is how we're going to stop Utah. And so the improvements they made as far as, hey, we're more comfortable against switches, we're okay with attacking one-on-one, we can attack these drops, that works if everything else is still going the same. And the problem is everything else kind of went left as more teams were like, hey, we'll drop, we'll show help, we'll switch on Rudy Gobert. So now your pick and roll attack isn't there. Your defense still has the same perimeter issues, so we feel comfortable on that and attacking. And we feel like we can get into a dogfight with y'all and win. And I got concerned with that in, like, February.
You did?
Like, you see how the, like, it was just how teams were guarding them. It was something that they would not even try last year. And more teams were comfortable doing it, and not even, like, good teams. It was the Pelicans before their run. Like, you'd see, like, the Pistons try it, and it was like, huh. Really? Okay, this is where we're at. And, you know, as the assortment of small guards switched on to Rudy Gobert, I was like, oh, this is a thing. So I don't know where you go with it if that's the book. Because Donovan Mitchell had a heck of a year, but as the Dallas series showed, his scoring didn't necessarily translate the way that I think Utah had hoped. or it couldn't have the same impact because they weren't making the same shots. They weren't getting the same stops. They weren't having the same flow. So I think it's got to be one or the other at this point. Somebody's got to go.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, it seems like it's gone a little bit too far to the ultimatum front. If we're to release some recent rumblings out there that Rudy Gobert is also at the him or me point. If you're there, like, make a move. And I think from there, you just kind of have to shape the team. And whoever you choose, if you choose to flip Rudy, if you choose to flip Donovan Mitchell, whoever you keep, you have to ship the team in their image at this point. I think if you're going full-blown Donovan Mitchell team, which I would assume that's the more likely option, then you're going to have to make him the primary. Let him run point, size up elsewhere, and go from there. And if it is a Rudy team, you replenish the assets because Utah's pick cupboard is a little bit bare right now based on some recent moves. Side note, I am still kind of confused by the Ingles deal, the Nikhil Alexander Walker deal. We're not going to go down that road again, but.
Nah, we're not.
You know what? I'll allow it. But but if you're going to go the Rudy route, get as much as you can, get as much. Honestly, if you're trading Donovan Mitchell, I think you kind of have to go all in on the rebuild at that point. Replenish the picks. Because, like, who's the comparable shot creator that you're getting back for Donovan Mitchell? Like, would Hero be the best guy you get?
Are you ready for an unpopular opinion?
Sure.
I think you could get more than that, especially with how many teams are trying to make moves to get into position and the free agent market and being what it will be. Why don't you just trade them both?
I wouldn't be super opposed. Because, like, here's the thing. If you're trading one of them, let's say you do trade Rudy Gobert. You move him to Chicago, or you move him to Atlanta, or you move him to, what was the point? Golden State might linger around. I don't know what you get from Golden State. Like, I don't think that's going to be a Wiggins spot, but whatever. You make the move for Rudy Gobert, your defense is probably going to be worse in some capacity, if not full sale worse. And if that's the case, you're basically banking on Donovan Mitchell to be like a guaranteed All-NBA guy, to carry the offense to the degree to where they're still going to maintain their seat. Like, they're going to be a 4-6 seed in the West. And I don't know how safe of a bet that is. And Donovan Mitchell's good, but, like, if you are losing your defensive foundation and asking Donovan Mitchell to carry it, like, you just talked about it in terms of, like, the Wolves, they got to do it again because other teams are coming. Like, one or both of the LA teams should be back in the mix next year. We should get healthier Denver next year. Like, New Orleans was 8 this year after the play-in and stuff, but they could be better. Like, that's going to be a lot. And so I don't think your idea is a bad one.
I'm only throwing it out there. I'm usually not let's just throw it all out type of guy. This would probably be a good vibes trade. No matter which way you go, you're hoping that we can just change the vibes. The issue is, if you deal Donovan, yes, you have the defense, you have the anchor, but you're probably going to have a lesser guard, still be dependent on guard play, and still have to deal with teams saying, we're going to switch these pick and rolls. So how much did you really fix? And if you trade Rudy Gobert, now you lose the backbone of your defense. You still have the defensive issues. You probably have a lesser big. So your pick and roll attack may not be better. And you're just hoping you get like a Luka KP vibe scenario where we just find some bigs that fit him better. And now we can do some of that stuff more. So I don't know. It's a mess. Feel bad for Mike Conley.
I also feel bad for Mike Conley. And that concludes my Mike Conley commentary on this episode of the podcast. All right. Let's dig into.
I was about to say, don't end this on episode 100.
not gonna do you like that. Not gonna do you like that. But all right, let's get to some game ones. Where do you want to start?
The floor is yours. I am here basking in the glory of Negodis Duncan. So just let me know where you want to go.
Oh, brother. All right. Well, we are recording on a Monday night. So let's dig into the game that we both watched before the podcast started. Heat Sixers. 106-92 victory for Miami. 24-12 for Bam. 25 for Tyler Hero. Relatively quiet night after a hot start from Jimmy Butler. Had 15 points. Also had 9 boards. I guess I'll just go open-ended for you. What was your, I guess, what stood out to you the most in that game?
I had a few things that stood out to me, but probably the biggest takeaway for going open-ended, Philly's got a template here to win this series and making competitive. Now, the math changes because Embiid's out, and I thought they did as much as they could in that first half and eventually ran out of steam. But there's a way they can kind of wiggle their way through this series. I thought there were some positives for Philadelphia as far as we can get Tyrese Maxey going. We can get Tobias Harris going. And we can use James Harden as a pressure point. Those are three positives, even with Embiid out. Now you bring Embiid back to the mix. Now you can kind of blend some things together. I was intrigued by their matchup hunting. I thought that was a big deal in this series in the first place. And you could see that they were trying to put Gabe Vincent in pick and roll with James Harden. They're trying to put Tyler Hero in pick and roll with James Harden, trying to get that mismatch and now attack. And you saw Miami kind of cycle through the coverages. Hey, we'll give you the switch. Now we're going to switch and double. And now you saw Philly hit Maxey. Now he's driving. But I thought Miami did feel more comfortable with the switch and double, which is the negative of having no Embiid. You have to kind of rely on that. So Miami can kind of get more comfortable with it. But I thought Philadelphia did some fun things as far as, okay, let's try and manipulate Miami's defense a little bit. Let's make sure the low man is small so that when we do get this and we switch and double or we get a pick and roll and you're two on the ball, we can hit the roller and finish. Just little things like that. Maxey Hero is an interesting matchup of two really good scorers that both teams want to attack, but that's my first takeaway. What did you think?
I was with you. Like, Philly has a template, and then that just kind of flipped me back to what is Miami's half-court offense going to look like in this series? And I feel like a broken record at times, but that's kind of where I went because the start was tremendous. Miami was kind of waltzing into pull-ups. Jimmy Butler got going early. They were able to get out and transition a little bit. Shots were falling. It was all fun. It's all fun. And then DeAndre Jordan goes off the floor. And Philadelphia's like, hey, actually, how about we throw in some zone? Let's see what kind of reads you're going to make. Let's see if y'all can keep the good vibes going. And things bogged down almost immediately. And I was like, see, this is why, even without Embiid out, I see this series going long. Because I don't see the consistency I would like to see with Miami's half-court attack. Just in terms of the decision-making, just in terms of generating good looks consistently, I didn't love what I saw from Miami late in that first half. And this is before you get into the fact, like, almost everyone shot poorly from three. Like, you'll see some regression, some positive regression moving forward, I think. But just from a process standpoint, Miami got bogged down and slowed down a little bit. They were hunting for things. Philadelphia was able to load up on some of their actions early in the clock. And from there, it was, okay, Jimmy save us. Bam save us. It's P.J. Tucker and Jimmy Butler running into each other in the corner trying to execute a handoff late in the clock. It's Caleb Martin taking bailout shots at the end of the clock. I'm just like, if Philadelphia can do this without Embiid on the floor or without Embiid available, then I am worried about when he's on the court, if they aren't able to keep their same pace up, what the offense is going to look like.
No, yeah, it's. I think that's a very key point. I thought Miami hit all the right notes they needed to early, aggressive, especially against the Philadelphia's bigs in a drop. I thought Gabe Vincent set a tone. As far as the series goes, big picture-wise, I think Philadelphia finding those different things defensively is important because now we can throw drop at you. We can throw zone at you. We can be active against your off-ball actions. We can switch if we go small. So there's different things they can throw at Miami. And for Miami, it's about the consistency and finding that blend offensively. When they had the ball movement and the player movement, they looked good. once they bogged down and went overly mismatch hunting or played slow, tempo wasn't good, that's where it got interesting. And the tough part for Miami is that's the template for almost any team. We just need to bring you into the mud offensively. That'll give us a chance to solve whatever you're throwing at us on that end. We'll have more shots at it. If we can just get y'all to miss some shots, we get some easy ones. Now we're flowing a little bit. We can attack more in the half court. They have to solve that problem. I thought they responded well. Now, Philadelphia kind of helped them a little bit because it felt like Doc wanted to go small after the success they had in the first half. But when he went small, Miami got like 95 offensive rebounds in a row. So Doc was immediately like, okay, let's not go small. And then Miami responded with sweet pick and roll. This is what we've been waiting for. And they pick and roll. Name a big, they pick and roll them to death. Paul Millsap, this is usually the time of year his knees thawed out. They are still in the freezer right now. DeAndre Jordan.
Go ahead.
Paul Reed.
Wait a minute. Oh, man. No, let's talk about DeAndre for a little bit. No isolation needed. But like, honestly, I felt bad for him. Just like early pick and rolls from Miami. Philadelphia was icing them. DeAndre was dropping back. And it was okay. Like, Miami hit some shots, but I didn't feel like DeAndre Jordan was just getting blasted in pick and roll early on. And you think, what, 2 or 3 minutes in, Philadelphia is beating Miami's press, which I want to talk about that a little bit too. But they beat the press. DeAndre's chilling in the dunker spot. He gets a lob off. I was like, okay, if DJ can hold serve in a drop against these Jimmy pick and rolls, and he can just do that, then okay, you can hold serve until you go to your smaller lineups. He just needs to be a bridge for them to get to the lineups that are really going to work. But after that initial stretch, it was just bad. And then he stuck.
Oh, yeah, no, I was going to say third quarter, Miami started doing some empty side stuff and starting to poke at that drop a little bit. And I was like, ah, yeah.
That's the one. And so I am a little bit concerned about DJ and game two moving forward. If you're zooming out, like, he just needs to be the bridge until Embiid comes back. But if Miami is going to go more empty corner stuff and like really hunt that matchup and hunt that coverage, I just don't know how much you can play him. And from there, I'm curious to see where Philadelphia goes. If you're listening to Doc Rivers, it's going to be much the same in game two. I don't know if you've seen the post game comments, but there was a
he's sick of y'all again.
We're gonna start DJ whether y'all like him or not because the players believe in him. And I was like,
this man is beyond fed up with y'all.
I was like, all right, well, if that's the energy, GG's, I respect it. But no, like, my thought there is, like, I don't know how much you can go DJ in game two. Even if you don't want to start Paul Reed because of the foul issues, and he does foul a lot. Honestly, I would start super small. Like, I'd go Tobias at the five and then flow into Paul Reed as your backup five if you're worried about the fouls in that three. Like, DJ's just feeding him drop. And you don't want to give Miami a pressure one. Because, again, once things got bogged down for Miami, once you took away drop, once they switched a little bit more or once they went to that zone specifically, that's when things really bogged down for them, particularly in the first half. If DJ's basically giving them a pocket to create something out of, you're letting them off the hook. And I don't think you can afford to do that.
Probably can't, but in theory, you're hoping that you can get, like you said, a bridge, and you can get enough of Jimmy Butler comes off and pick and roll, two dribbles, we recover, we're good type of scenarios, rather than empty side pick and roll, wait, where's Bam type deals. So it's going to be on Miami to hit that pressure point when DeAndre's on the floor. And I thought in the second half, they did a good job of saying, anytime there's a big, go for it. My only concern is DeAndre almost has to start by default to me. So like, starting super small wouldn't be bad. The only issue is now, yeah, you can go to Paul Reed, but if that doesn't work, you're kind of back in the same boat. And as much as I like that super small lineup, it also needs George Niang to hit shots. And it feels like he's kind of in the, and this is no disrespect, the Al Horford playoff zone, where knocks down a whole bunch of shots, and now this is the time for you to continue to do so, and you have not.
Nearly 22 minutes, 0 points, 0-7 from three. That is probably a hot take on my end, but that is not going to cut it if you are looking to generate good offense.
we only bring the spice here on the dunker spot.
This is very true. Were you about to say something?
I was going to say, how did you like the full court press from Miami, where they said, hey, PJ Tucker, you just go bother James Harden as much as possible. And when you come out, Victor Oladipo, you go ahead and do it. I thought that was a fun game within the game for me.
I didn't love it. And I
really?
I wasn't. I felt like the theory behind it is sound. And this isn't something that Miami's just sprinkling out for the first time. Like, they've been pressing teams for large chunks of the year. So I get it. I didn't like it in this one, mostly because with this being more of a Harden-centric offense with Embiid out, I think the template for Philadelphia offensively, I think they want to be able to push a little bit. They want to be able to play with a little bit more pace and see if you can get some cracks in Miami switches and things like that. And the press, especially once Philly started screening high and trying to get hitting Tucker, hitting Vincent, whatever you got, that matchup and stuff, Harden was able to get downhill a little bit easier. And if Harden's able to touch the paint, like, he can still create open looks for you. Again, for Philadelphia tonight, they just couldn't hit anything at all. 6 of 34 from three. But from a process standpoint, the press didn't really work. They were able to break it pretty easily. He was able to get downhill. And once you're playing with that kind of pace, that unlocks Maxey a little bit more. And I think if you're Miami, like, Philly wants to get Miami in the mud, I think Miami wants Philly to be in the mud. You want this to turn into 15 or 16 seconds of James Harden dribbling around versus, well, high screen 55 feet from the basket. Now we're in rotation a little bit. Miami's good enough to deal with that, but you don't want to feed Philadelphia looks.
No, I understand. I think I like the fact that it was kind of like a body blow game long type deal where, hey, this is just going to be annoying for you. Yeah, I like the responsibility to have more pressure release screens, let them get some space, then come with your mismatch screen. Now Miami has to react a little bit. Maybe you give a switch you didn't think about giving, that type of deal. So I thought it was effective that way. I'm interested to see how they go do that going forward. I wonder how much they let Tyrese Maxey initiate the next game, because he had some moments in space where it didn't look like Miami could keep him in front. And I think the more they can unlock him, the more they can set high screens for him and let him get downhill. And now mix that in with what Harden is doing with mismatches, and hopefully you can continue to get Tobias going against certain people. That can get interesting, but it's going to be based on those three. Now, again, this is the issue with the series. Embiid's coming back at some point. And so all of this that they've established may become more powerful once he's back. And we have that pressure point that you have to deal with. And now we're just kind of going through the motions a little bit, just like the Toronto series. Because if you think about it, yeah, they were mismatch hunting with Harden. But now what's it going to look like when they get that mismatch and now Embiid comes to screen, a la the Raptors series? Does that become two on the ball? Does that open things up for Philadelphia? Who knows?
Can get a little bit dangerous there. On the Embiid adjacent front, if I want to talk about DeAndre Jordan, this may not be the matchup for him until Embiid comes back. I don't know how much more Dwayne Dedman I want to see.
Folks, we did it. We did it. We did it. Nekias has seen the light, everyone. We have seen it. I cannot believe
you sat
on this podcast less than a year ago and told me that Gorgui Dieng and Dwayne Dedman were the two best bigs out on the market and slandered DeMarcus Cousins' good name.
DeMarcus recorded the podcast with us. What you mean?
The GOAT.
You got it, but no. 5 fouls in 4 minutes is not what you want to see from Dwayne Dedman. I feel like you kind of have to mirror the minutes with DeAndre.
Just play PJ at the five, Jimmy.
Yes.
With other guards. There's no need. There's no need for... What's your line? Society has progressed past. Yep.
I will say, like, in beatless games, I don't think Miami's going to beat Devin right now. I think they'll be all right with transitioning to some PJ at the five as their, like, backup five. And you can kind of reconfigure the rotation to make that work. Once Embiid's there, like, Devin is still a pretty solid post defender, and you want him to eat up fouls so Bam doesn't have to in that regard. But without that matchup, he's not offering you much as a scorer. Defense, like, it's... I think they're all right.
All right, all right. What was also interesting was Jimmy Butler attacking Tyrese Maxey. Miami looking to attack that matchup. That intrigued me. Bam had a really solid game. I thought for a minute we were going to get an aggressive rant from you tonight, but he turned that around. So,
I was pretty proud of Bam.
Duncan Robinson, DNP, were you expecting that? Or?
Was not expecting that. Was expecting limited minutes, maybe. I didn't think he just wasn't going to play. That's a bit odd to me. Victor Oladipo completely taking that rotation spot. Because Caleb Martin was going to be there regardless.
I wonder if that's more matchup based.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you, against Harden, at the very least, like, you didn't want to have a situation where he has two guys on the court at the same time that you can kind of mismatch hunt with. So I get it. Still a little bit surprising we didn't see him at all. Like, even once it turned into garbage time, there was no Duncan Robinson. Well, I don't know. Hey, that's a little bit.
No, yeah. I mean, Miami just can't turn the ball over. They have to find the blend offensively. They can't turn it over, and they've got to make sure they keep Jimmy Butler in this aggressive zone and not let him get bogged down, because it felt like Philadelphia felt okay with his drives, try to defend without fouling, try and live with the pull-ups, go under if he's on off-ball actions. So he's got to find the counter, because they're going to need him as this series goes deeper and deeper. It was a great response in the second half from Miami, but Philadelphia did show a few things to make this a series if they hit the right points and if Joel Embiid comes back.
Yeah, they're going to need him back as soon and as safely as possible. Don't want to rush him back just because, but yeah, the template is there. Also, just quick shout out to Tyler Hero and Bam. Their pick and roll combination, 1.7 points per possession, which is insane. You want to throw one quick Nikhaya Lidic out there. But
six, I like it.
Didn't have an answer for that one. All right, let's go to the Sunday games. Bucks Celtics. What a win for the Milwaukee Bucks. 12-point victory. A dominant Giannis performance without shooting well. Had a triple-double, but flew around defensively. Kind of dominated the painted area on both ends. Drew Holiday with 25, 9, and 5. Jason Tatum had 21, but did so on 18 shots. Jaylen Brown with 12 points on 13 shots was not a great outing for him as well. Steve, what stood out to you in this game one?
Well, there's a lot to take away from it. And I think we have maybe some, I don't want to say differing views, but different takeaways, which is the fun of basketball. And this is a fun series when you adjust from what both these teams did in round one to this round. I do want to start with, despite the box score, I thought Giannis was incredible in that game on both ends of the floor. I thought he gave them a little bit of everything. And this version of Giannis is incredibly tough to deal with. Man can drive. Make a post, make an ISO. The improved passing versus your double teams, your walls in transition, that's difficult. And I know every time I talk about Giannis's jumper, everyone wants to throw percentages out there. I get it. But it's tough when he's willing to take that pull-up, like deciding to take that pull-up. It's a mindset type deal. Like, when you're defending a great player, there's usually one thing, okay, I can try and live with this. If he's choosing the one thing, like, not just, hey, I'm going to take this because you're off me. Like, no, two dribbles, 1-2 right up. Bang you in the post, fade away, one-legged. Like, he's choosing to mix those in. He only has to hit so many of them. Because also, what's the turbo button these days? R2?
Yes.
There. R2X circle.
Whatever the one.
So, yeah, it just felt like that was a game where Boston was trying to find one thing to live with, find a poison they could take, and he just kept delivering them different flavors. So I wanted to give him a salute, but where do we even want to start with this one? Do you want to start Milwaukee's defense? Do you want to talk Boston's offense? How do we balance that out? Because I think there's takeaways on both ends here.
Yeah, this was the fun game for me. Let's start with, I just want to give some love to Milwaukee's defense.
Yes, preach the gospel, Nagotis.
Will you please? I was a little surprised with some of the matchups. Namely, Giannis got Jaylen Brown to start. I was expecting him to get the Horford matchup. Like, all right, that puts him in pick and rolls, let him switch some of the spacier pick and roll options for Boston, but also Horford's off ball. And we'll dig into that as well with Boston's offense. But if Horford's off ball, that gives Giannis the ability to roam and really lurk as a help defender, which is where he's at his best. But they put him on Jaylen Brown. They had him switching some stuff. They had him fighting over screens other times. That was a little bit messy. But overall, oh, go ahead.
I'm going to pause you here because I think that was an important piece of this. They didn't care who Giannis was guarding. He had one job and he was going to do it, and y'all have to deal with it. Y'all have to make us pay for that, which I think is very interesting considering Boston just had a series where they did the same thing with Al Horford. And they said, hey, you have to find a way to make that guy pay. If you can't make that guy pay, we're going to win. And Giannis did so many things defensively to where it was like, oh, wow. You know what I mean? Just like, he's not just helping off Grant Williams. He's helping off Jaylen Brown and selling out on the drive. But continue.
Oh, with you. I was just going to say the way that Milwaukee dominated the painted area, not even just dominated the painted area, the way they dominated inside the arc, I think that's a more accurate way to put what Milwaukee did. Because it's easy to talk about what they do as a drop defense, what Brook Lopez does, which, credit to him, played a little bit higher, but it was still a drop. But what he does as a drop defender, what Giannis does as a weak side defender or when he's in drop. But Milwaukee, what made them tough against Boston's game one, they dropped and they also showed aggressive help. And so you didn't really have clean pockets anywhere inside the arc. Because naturally, if you go drop, you have some pull-up three opportunities, or in theory, you'd have some pull-up mid-range jumpers. They didn't really have those. Because depending on where Boston had their guy spaced, like if you had a high pick and roll with Jason Tatum, you had Marcus Smart on either one of the wings, and you had Horford somewhere else. Those guys, whoever defended those guys, are there just pinching in. So Tatum may come off the screen. If the pull-up three isn't there, the pull-up two isn't there either. Like he's just seeing bodies and hands everywhere. And that's before you get into the fact that, okay, these guys are also dropping into the paint. You can't get to the rim either. So it's just the way that they constricted space was pretty impressive to me.
They nailed every rotation, every recovery, and sold out on every drive. And that was incredibly impressive. Because as you mentioned, I want to give Brooke a salute. He was consistently at the level without overcommitting. And anytime there was a drive, because Boston had the kicks and they were driving on those closeouts, but they were immediately met with a help defender. And Milwaukee was flying around. If you're going to do that, you have to nail every rotation. Because if you're late, now you're giving up layups. And I think that's such a key part of this series for both sides. You know, when you talk about Boston, it's great that you can get two on the ball. Because that was my concern with this series. Oh, Milwaukee's going to be in a drop. Boston can't get the rhythm. They're going to bog down, et cetera, et cetera. They got two on the ball, but what they did with it is going to be huge. And what they do with it going forward is going to be big. They didn't get the easy baskets out of it because of the paint protection. So even though you're getting those same looks that you hit against Brooklyn or good looks for what you want as a team, now you have to make those because they're not giving you anything else. And that puts pressure on Williams, Horford, Pritchard, those same in-rhythm shots they had because they were also getting the mismatches. They were also getting easy transition baskets. They were also getting drives and finishes. Nope, this is the one. And so it becomes, how does Boston balance those shots, those quality looks they generated, with also still putting pressure on Boston, on Milwaukee's defense, and being able to finish and get in the paint? Mm-hmm. But continue. Sorry. So I'm excited. I like the series.
No, I'm right there with you. And to that point, and we talked about this in the lead up to this series, like what Boston is going to see from a size perspective, it's going to be an adjustment period for them. And I think not that their offensive process was like horrible, and it wasn't bad in the Brooklyn series either. But like now where you're spacing your guys is even more important. Because in the Brooklyn series, you could get away with, okay, we got two bad shooters on one side. Or it didn't matter because the guy you're hunting, I mean, you're going against a lineup with 3-6-3 dudes. So sure, those guys may be able to help, but that help is also small. And you're not really worried about it. Against Milwaukee, yeah, if you're running a pick and roll, you got Derek White as the single side shooter. Yeah, that's probably going to matter a little bit more now. Because that guy's peeling over and you're already dealing with size in front of you. So now you have more to deal with. And I think there was enough small stuff for Boston from a space perspective that popped up where it's like, okay, this is low-hanging fruit for them. But this is also something I don't think they really had to account for in round. So I'm going to be curious to see like what those adjustments are going to be like in game two. Like there was a brief stretch in the first half where they're waiting on a sub, but you did get Derek White and Marcus Small on the floor at the same time for a short stretch. And it was immediately five guys in the paint. And I was like, oh, this is a team that has scouted well. This is a team that's saying, no, you're not beating us with anything easy. And if you have bad shooters on the floor or if you are not spaced correctly, we are going to make you pay. And you're going to have to beat us with tough shots. And the open shots that we're feeding you are from guys that we want to take those shots. And so I'm curious to see how Boston's able to counter that as well.
And it's interesting. Boston ends up with kind of the same scenario they struggled with earlier in the season with how teams were defending some of their lineups and shooters, despite the percentages against perception. You know, you need to be a threat. You have to knock down the shots that are there. You can't be, you know, if you're Grant Williams at Horford, you can't get tight. You got to keep letting it fly. And back to your size point, Brooklyn may have helped off of Smart and White, but those guys could also not just make shots. They were driving closeouts. They could also get a paint touch. That's where Milwaukee's size helps because, hey, we can help and recover. And now what are you going to do? We're going to contain this drive. And if we don't, there's more help behind it and we're still going to get back out. So that's kind of the balance there. I thought Boston made a few good adjustments. I thought setting screens higher for Tatum was good just as a way to get him downhill. I guess my issue is a little bit of how much he had to initiate in this game just because he was the pressure point as far as opening things up. I think getting Brooke on the move would be something they should try to explore. If he's going to be at the level consistently, try and screen for him before. Make him make multiple efforts. Now see if you can get downhill, what it creates. And then I'm interested to see the adjustments as well. Do they go more empty corner? Are they able to space and manipulate a little bit more that way to make Milwaukee think about the help they were showing? But, you know, you have the base of getting two on the ball, and now you just got to make them pay.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm glad you brought up the screening before the screen point, because they did do that once. One play that stood out for me, and I put it in the thread that I did on the game, where they had kind of some screen-to-screener action that led into a Smart Tatum pick and roll. Because, like, that pick and roll combo did not do much in game one. And part of that was just because Milwaukee was locked in on it. Some of the matchups that they tossed out there, it was easier to switch, or the screen navigation was there. And on that point, Wes Matthews deserves his flowers for the work that he is doing fighting over screens. That man is very good. Still. But wait, what's the, oh no, what did I do?
No, you're good. Continue.
Ah, I see. I thought I said something wrong, but no, I just want to give Wes Matthews some props. Like, he did get the Jason Tatum assignment and he made him work. And even with some of the screen to screen stuff Boston tried to sprinkle in, like, he was able to navigate those screens. He was able to bother Tatum throughout the night. And this wasn't a game where Jason Tatum had the contested jumpers going. That may change in game two, but for game one, at least he's a big reason. And again, if Wes Matthews can do that, that means you can deploy Jrue Holiday elsewhere. And that allows Giannis to roam elsewhere. And you're keyed in pretty much elsewhere. Like, that's the entire point of having a guy like Wes Matthews in the lineup. Like, he takes pressure off for everyone else and allows them to help more aggressively. So if he's able to hold serve, that is going to put quite a damper on what Boston wants to do offensively.
And I thought Bobby Portis held up his end of the bargain. That is important.
Good defensive game for him.
They needed that because, again, if Boston can find a pressure point in that Milwaukee defense, this changes things to where now you're having to show help as opposed to desiring to show help, which is a slight difference. It's a Jaylen Brown series for Boston. They need his drives. They need his force. They need his scoring. They need his finishing. They need his attacks in transition. They need his paint touches. They need him to be able to be the guy to make Milwaukee pay. He can't be in the group of "we're helping off you." If nothing else, he has to be the person they can put on the weak side to make you think about not helping.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to be able to initiate and create some of the same pressure, same opportunities. So now his paint touches open up a kick to Tatum. But now Tatum can attack a scrambling defense. And now you can play that way. But it's tough for me to see this working if Jaylen Brown can't get it going.
And I think that's where the Giannis matchup is key. And again, they were able to generate some looks here or there with Giannis. Because again, as great as Giannis is defensively, screen navigation isn't his strong suit. So they did run some off-ball stuff for Jaylen Brown to get him free. There was some Tatum screening for Brown action early in the game that created a three. You can't have Brown not knocking down shots and also not being able to get to the rim and also missing reads as a passer whenever he is able to drive into the paint. Like, that, it was just an all-around bad performance. That's something that I expect him to bounce back from. But you really felt it on the night, well, on an afternoon like Sunday, when everyone else is already kind of stressed based on what Milwaukee's doing defensively. Actually, to your earlier point about Al Horford, he did get the threes up, took 9 of them. But also, that feels like a win if you're Milwaukee.
It feels like a win until he starts making them. And that's the tricky part with Al. The last thing he can do is pass him up. He's got to keep shooting them. If he starts getting hesitant, that's the big win for Milwaukee. If you've left him enough to where now he's passing these up, trying to look for another handoff, now you really won. Speaking of Al Horford, is this spooky time for demon time?
I need to see another game because I do think overall he was pretty solid defensively, but there were some possessions where he was just on an island against Giannis. I'm just like, yo, don't do that against Al Horford. Like, I understand trying to do that if you switch him out onto KD, just because KD isn't like the paint presence. And you can kind of be like, okay, this isn't great. I mean, we don't love this, but you can force him into the jumper. You can't give him single coverage with Giannis consistently because Giannis is going to get down.
That's the tough part. It felt like the Nets couldn't make Al Horford a pressure point, and Giannis feels like he is the pressure point, and it's a different kind of drive. It's a different kind of pressure. And the other thing I kind of wanted to bleed into is, how about the Bucks cutting? How about the cutting in that game? I thought they made a really good adjustment from how they looked in the Chicago series early to what they did in this game one. It's not as easy for Boston to load up in this series. Despite the personnel, guys are cutting. Depending on where Giannis is, they're diving. They got to make sure they don't double cut at the same time, but there's different cuts. There's different spacing. They got shooters spaced one pass away. They've got guards at the dunker spot sometimes. They got Brook Lopez starting high and then diving. So they're doing little things to kind of chip away at Boston's automatic help and doubles. And again, Giannis's passing has been really good. So that's one of those little things I'm watching in the half court where it's like, it's not as easy. You know, you want to give Horford the switch and you want to show early help, but I don't know if my man's cutting. I don't know where I'm going to be the next possession. It's not as stagnant as before. And that paint pressure is different, man. We just got to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's a blend. Like, Jrue Holiday presents a different challenge because, and how many just response shots that he hit this year, where it just seems like things are going one way and here he comes, that one dribble pull up. You don't even see it. Like they're panning to whoever scored, and then all of a sudden you just see Drew Holiday shooting a three, and it's like, oh, okay, all right. And then he might just turn the corner and just shoulder you in the chest. It's different.
Just a tad bit different. And I'm glad you brought up the pro. I was proud of Milwaukee with the way that they spaced around Giannis. I was like, wow, this is Grayson Allen one pass away multiple times in a row. And Grayson Allen getting wide open shots. This is cool. This is good stuff. Keep doing that. And that's, I guess that's the scary thing with Milwaukee. If they're able to figure this stuff out, again, like we have to note, like they won game one, no Chris Middleton, don't know when Middleton's coming back. If they space the floor well enough, like is Bobby Portis as good as Chris Middleton? No. Is Pat Connaughton or Grayson Allen as good as them? No. Are they respected shooters that you have to account for? Yes. And so if you space those guys around Giannis, who is a walking paint touch, who will get to the rim and score, get to the rim, get to the free throw line, or get to the rim and draw two or three bodies and at least open shots, as long as you are spacing the floor correctly, you can generate the same level of looks pretty consistently, even with Middleton off the floor. And so it's going to be up to Milwaukee to keep their good process up, make sure they're spacing correctly, make sure they're not feeding Boston the easy automatic so they can take away some of the cuts that you have. If you put that kind of stress on them, it's just going to come down to like, okay, how good are your guys? How tall are your guys? How physical are your guys? And as Jan has shown, Al Horford's been really good defensively this year. He is a good defender. You can't leave him on an island consistently against Giannis. Giannis went hunting for the Robert Williams matchup in this game. As good of a defender as Rob Williams is, he's not dealing with those body blows from Giannis consistently. My goodness, how much Daniel Tice did we even see? Did we see Daniel Tice? So, I mean, it's just a different ordeal. Like, the paint pressure is so different for Milwaukee. Like, if they keep the process up, they can dictate things in a way that Brooklyn just couldn't.
Nah, I'm with you. But 84 field goal attempts, 53-point shots. And I guess the positive for me for Boston, 28 made field goals, 21 assists. So you still have your flow going. You know you can create opportunities for each other. I want to see what it looks like if they're able to get some more paint touches, some more finishes, make a couple more shots, because the exploit is there. And Milwaukee is going to have to be locked in like that the entire time. Now, the tricky part for Boston is it wasn't even as solid as I thought Milwaukee was, as much as I liked what some of the things they did offensively. It wasn't their best shooting or scoring game. So, you know, the tough part is, does Boston make the adjustments, but also Milwaukee plays better offensively, so it doesn't matter as much. That's the hard part about a playoff series.
Yeah.
We figured this out, and now you've given us a whole different problem.
Yeah. Giannis went 9 of 25 in that game. They did see a lot of bodies and a lot of attention. He also just missed some bunnies. Like, this very well could have been a 35, 12, and 13 game or whatever for Giannis had he made some layups. And so, like, there's the fact that there's low-hanging fruit for Giannis, and he still dominated that game.
Yeah. They just got to pick one poison with Giannis, and I think they got to figure out however they want to treat Drew. They got to try and make him ineffective. They can't have both of them going. Not in this series.
Yeah, they can't afford to. How'd you feel about the Marcus Smart game on ball?
On offense?
Yeah.
I think it's just going to be a tough series for him with the way they're defending. Not going to be as easy for him to initiate. There's not many actions for him. I thought he tried to do a good job driving when he got the kicks, but he was driving in to help. So it's going to be, you know, can his secondary drives create more offense? If they do, it's a big plus. If they don't, now he's having to make shots to have an impact. You know, we didn't see the same left-hand layups, post-ups, that type of deal, screening or anything like that. So I'm interested to see what they can do to loosen him up, because he's an important part of their offense. Where were you at with it?
I wasn't a fan, honestly. It was similar to you. Like, it's just the way Milwaukee's defense was set up. Like, there weren't really any easy pockets for him to drive into. And then they were feeding him shots off the ball. But again, that's by design. They want him shooting a bunch of threes. So on the ball, like, I go back to your earlier point, like, maybe you have a guy screen for the big before setting the pick and roll, just so you can get him downhill. Because if Smart is able to get those downhill touches, like, he is a good passer. And that's how you allow both Brown and Tatum the opportunity to attack some scrambling defenses, attack some of those closeouts from Milwaukee. But if Smart can't get going, then you have to rely on Tatum to kind of run the show. And if he's running the show, that's someone helping off of Smart, which is already restricting space. And if you're able to force the ball out of Tatum's hands, and they're also helping off of non-shooters, then what are the avenues that Jaylen Brown is attacking at that point? So I think Smart's role offensively is going to be very important. They're going to need to find a way to loosen him up. Do we have any lasting thoughts on that game one?
Nope, can't wait to see game two.
All right, I am with you. Let's close this out with Warriors-Grizzlies, a thriller, a one-point victory.
What a phenomenal basketball game, by the way.
That was a fun game.
That fourth quarter, I was threatened, but I was also just kind of watching in awe. Like, that was just a really, really fun playoff game, two teams dealing haymakers. Good stuff. You got Draymond dapping people up in the tunnel.
I guess we can start there before we dig into, like, the X's and O's of it all. Like, did you think that was a flagrant two? Or did you think it would have been a flagrant one? Or how did you feel about the call?
This is the dunker spot, right?
Yes.
Next question.
All right.
No. That man got ejected and went on and recorded his own podcast. I'm not making that mistake. You're not getting me thrown over the top rope. Nope.
Why would you? You actually watch games. What do you mean?
Don't matter. Nope. I know that's such an amazing switch. You get ejected from a game, your team wins, and then you just go record a pod. And, like, I'm not even saying that in a hateful way. It's just such an extreme switch. Like, normally you have to wait for, like, a press clipping or a news conference. Nope, I'm going to put this out.
You got podcast screenshots on the timeline before the episode drops. They're coming soon. The volume. Like, all right, this is, you know what? I mean, he had plenty of time to record. I understand. Like, I respect it. I guess to answer my own question, like, I fell into that should have been a flagrant one camp until I saw the alternate view where I saw him, like, hit Brandon Clark in the face pretty cleanly. And then, like, you can't do that. Accidental or not, like, you can't do that. That's a lot. Anyway, on to the X's and O's. How did you feel about Memphis against Golden State small lineup, or the newer version of the small lineup since Dre went down?
I mean, there's differences. I was intrigued with how Golden State starting out Gary Payton the second and putting him right on John Morant, told me what time it was with that lineup, and how, hey, now we're going to make whatever Draymond is involved in a switch and keep in front. I was more fascinated by, like, the other things in this one, to be honest with you. Just noticing the differences. Because it's a different series for John Morant this time. It's not two on the ball every time. So you can see he's playing with an element of freedom. You can see his mindset is shifting, where he knows, hey, I can get a switch. I can drive and score. And maybe I don't see nine bodies immediately. You know, it's different. Think about in the Minnesota series, Memphis would run Horns 35. They send it off away from the big, and it's a switch that you don't necessarily want. Here is Steph Curry. And now I can back out, and I look to my left, I look to my right. Wait, they're not right there? They're not already in my lap? I can do a crossover, spin, get in the paint. There's more comfort for him. So I thought that was important. Just the mismatches that he can create, just the dribble penetration that Memphis could have. I thought Jaren Jackson Jr. also is in a different series, which I had anticipated just because Minnesota had the size to take a lot of the stuff off the table and Golden State doesn't at every position. So now you can see the post-ups, the seals, the rebounds. Now he's in a flow hitting threes.
God, it, the third quarter.
That it just has to be fun for Ja to be able to drive, not immediately see help, draw help, and now make a kick, as opposed to everyone staring at me. I take two dribbles. They keep staring at me. Now I'm kicking, and they recover. That to me was the big difference. What were your takeaways as far as Memphis against that small lineup?
They have pockets to attack. They just have to attack them consistently. And on the other end, and I think my big takeaway in this game was Memphis's defense. Because it got better in the second half, but there were so many lapses at the end of possessions for them.
Like, yeah, they really set the tone with Tillman.
You wanna spin the block on that one?
We're doing show and recovery again with Steph Curry. That's great stuff.
I take it you are not a fan of that strategy against Steph Curry.
No, they need to find a coverage for him in a hurry. I mean, if you're going to start him, that's okay. But you need to find something that you want to live with him defensively, or else what are we accomplishing? Like, I know you don't want to go exactly straight small and match up with Golden State in that way, but it can't be that. Because if he gets a bullseye on him, it's a little bit different than in the Minnesota series.
Yeah, there's a lot of shooting that you have to deal with, and a lot of a little bit worried about Xavier. I did like when we won. This is a game. Jaren scored incredibly well, and you mentioned that how different things look, how more the drives were a little bit more open. More post-ups against wings. Like, he got Wiggins a few times. He got Clay a few times. He had fun. And then once the three started falling, he lost his mind in the third quarter. That was probably my favorite part of the thread. With those, both of the teams were just going back and forth. It's like, oh, well, here's Jordan Poole. Oh, there's Jaren Jackson Jr. again. Oh, there's a jaw drive. There's Jaren Jackson Jr. again. There's a Clay shot. There's a Steph step back. There's Jaren Jackson Jr. again. I'm just like, yo. This is the Jaren we were promised. This is what he can do when the shot's falling. And this is what he can do when he's actually on the court and able to establish a rhythm. So let's keep that up so we can see more Jaren in the series.
No, I'm with you. Let's circle back to Memphis' defense for a second, because I do want to hear where your concern level is, because you were also concerned last series. I think last series it was no early help. This series sounds like the lapses, right?
Yeah, it's the lapses. I like them most of the time, the first 10 or 12 seconds of the clock. And then you would have Jaren drop back to kind of survey where the action's going, and then they're waltzing into a handoff, because that's what Golden State does. Or you may get a Steph pick and roll that you contain, and then Steph gives the ball up, and he, you know, hands it off, runs to the other side of the court. And then you lose track of him because you're looking at a drive that's happening after you gave the ball up. And it's like, no, Steph Curry doesn't stop moving. You can't do that. Jordan Poole doesn't stop moving. You can't do that. Klay Thompson also doesn't stop moving. You can't do that. one of the plays that I clipped in my thread for this game, it was in the third quarter, where Steph was able to get, walked into one of those Kevon Looney plays. And I think my caption was, I wonder what my podcast co-host would think of this possession. Because Jaren had sunk back after the initial action. He's like surveying, okay, who's going where? There's a cut here, yada, yada. And Kevon Looney has the ball. He's like, oh, well, cool. Steph's just going to run D'Anthony Melton off of Kevon Looney on his handoff. He's going to get a three and knock it down. It's like, these are the Warriors. This is a team that you have played well over the last year and a half. You know what they do. Like, this is your first playoff series against them. But you've played this team, what, 7-8 times over the last year and a half?
No, I'm with you. In the second round, it's always interesting to see how teams defend as the series goes on. Because to me, I think there is a little bit of a culture shock, so to speak, as you move from one series to the next, especially when you have two teams that are as different as these two were. So Minnesota, you may get some stagnation. You know you're going to double. You have rotations you want to make. Golden State is sudden. And so you mentioned they had some solid possessions of defense, but then had breakdowns. It's going to be on Memphis to stay solid and locked in, because those cuts happen quick. It's going to take multiple efforts. If you're going to sit back off Draymond Green, just like we talked about in the Denver series, he's going to find someone, and someone's coming off, and now you got to deal with it. So the more that Memphis is able to be physical off ball, be more locked in on the cuts, communicate, that's going to help them more than kind of the help they had to display in the last series. But it's a tricky process because it does not take much as far as falling asleep against Golden State. You can't ball watch this series.
Yeah. And on that front, I need to see better from John Morant on defense. I need to see a lot better from John Morant on defense. The off-ball lapses were pretty bad. And on the ball, Golden State went after him in pick and roll early.
How'd you feel about that? Because they kept doing it.
They should keep doing it.
Dunker Spot Community, I did have him on my list of rants that Nekias would have in this postseason. So, hey, put that off to the bingo board. I thought it was interesting the Grizzlies did not want to give up that switch ever. That intrigued me.
Which I get it because you don't want him to get baked on ball, but like also you're just opening up more things because the show and recover opens up a spot. And that's before we're getting into like how fast the show or the recover is. And then sometimes it's just getting lost during the recover phrase. And this is like, yo, these are the Warriors. You can't give them these kind of cracks. Like, that's not what you want to do. And so, like, if I'm Memphis, like, had some missed free throws in there, they gave up a ton of offensive rebounds to the Warriors, which also bleeds into the finishing possession point. Like, there's so much low-hanging fruit for them to grab. But it kind of starts up top. Like, it was the off-ball defense for Ja. He was getting the 100 to pick and roll. And then 11 threes. I don't know how I feel about it. How did you feel about the threes?
From who?
From Ja.
I thought it was a freedom mindset type deal. I thought it was I'm going to try and make you pay. I'm feeling it. Well, he made his first two, right?
Yeah.
And then I think he just felt like he was on one. I didn't mind it. I think he was trying to make a point, but I don't know. Because here's the thing. If he hits them and however many he has to hit, if he's also driving in this fashion, they don't hurt as much. But if those are the only ones he's taking, then it's a different feel for me. So I was, I guess, indifferent. Did you have a take on it?
I didn't love it. Because even the first two that he made, like, it wasn't like a flow deal. So that's where I'm just kind of like, I get the mindset point. Like, I don't think that's invalid at all. But I didn't love the process of some of the ones that he took. And then once he went cold, he was still taking them. He did drive enough to where it wasn't a capital P problem. But you look at the box score and it's 11 threes for Ja. And he didn't make 8 of them. I'm just like, okay, what exactly is the plan here? Because Golden State wants you to take those shots, even if you're trying to prove it. Like, they are conceding these looks to you.
Man. T. Morant, Nekias Duncan.
Oh, here we go.
Nekias Duncan, unite.
I don't know how I feel about that one, I'm going to be honest.
No, it's fine. It's a bad shot. I thought Memphis had the right idea with dribble penetration. It felt like everyone felt a little more freer against Golden State's lineup. And I do want to see how they space Draymond and Looney going forward. Just because if you can get scenarios where Golden State's switching and those guys are away from the ball or in the strong side corner, can't provide the same level of help, I think it's clear you can beat some of these closeouts. If you can get to that second level, there's a comfort as far as finishing or driving and kicking. So I'm interested to see how they handle that. And then for Golden State, where are you at with Jordan Poole? As far as starting, not starting?
Honestly, like, I think I'm probably okay with him coming off the bench. Like, I get why you started GP2. And they got enough out of him offensively to make that worth it. They did use him as a screener quite a bit. He got free on a few cuts. Again, more lapses from Memphis defensively. I think if you get enough from him offensively, the point of attack defense on job, like, it makes sense.
All right. I had reached a point during that game where I was like, hey, there's no way you can't do it. But I've been mad around before, so it's okay. I do like the point of Gary Payton actually being able to be a screener in this series because of some of the matchups. That's important. I'm surprised we didn't get a Melton rant out of you.
He botched some stuff on defense too.
Ah.
But
if only.
Here we go. He did also get some timely boards. He also made some threes. Like, he played well overall. So no Melton rant from me. It was nice to see him back on the court. Like, I guess we can start there. Because he had fallen. We didn't see much of him in that Minnesota series. So nice to see him.
I want to see how they try and unlock Desmond Mane and Dylan Brooks in the next game.
Does Dylan Brooks need unlocking? I guess is the question. That man airballed an open corner three. I was like, okay, if this is the Dylan Brooks we're getting, it ain't like he's going to be shy out there. Oh, jeez.
How'd you feel about Golden State putting Curry on Desmond?
Not a surprise. I didn't think he was going to get Ja. Like, he probably switched on to him, which he did switch on to him a few possessions. And he let Ja know about it late in that game when he got the block. But no, not a surprise. I don't think you want to put him on Dylan Brooks just because that's a lot of physicality and antics. You don't really want to make Steph deal with that on both ends. And so with Bane, depending on what actually they're running him in, like, I think Steph's going to be fine there. So I think that's going to be the spot for him until Memphis is able to make him pay.
That's the key. They got to win that matchup early and often, to me. But it's going to be a series, man.
It is going to be a series. Can I throw out one more shout out before we get out of here?
Andrew Wiggins?
Yes, Andrew Wiggins played himself one heck of a basketball game.
Klay Thompson slander continues.
How's the wait a minute? How's that Klay Thompson slander?
How many big shots does this guy have to make before you mention his name?
What he put him ahead with a three. It was a great shot. Actually, on the Klay front, how do you feel about him taking on the took on the Tillman matchup?
I liked it.
That was interesting.
I didn't see that coming. He's important for them defensively. So I'm going to let you have the ISO and either slander Klay or apologize to Wiggins. It's fine.
I have no reason to slander. Well, no, I don't have reason to slander Klay. I will say Ja went hunting for him towards the end of the game. That was interesting. But I don't think that counts as slander. That's just Ja finding a matchup that he likes and driving repeatedly. But on the Wiggins front, timely boards, timely shot making, timely post-ups. He got the job matchup sometimes too, offensively, and made him pay. Again, just not a very good job defensive game, but Andrew Wiggins made a lot of little plays in that one. Golden State does not win without some of the plays he made, especially late in that game. So I wanted to shout out the hashtag all-star for a minute.
I'm with it. I just want to see, does Memphis's multiple efforts increase defensively? Are they more locked into the movement? Can Golden State be more solid defensively if they're going to be small, if they're going to switch? Can they keep the ball in front? Because Memphis has a mindset to drive the ball in a different fashion than the last series. How much Curry and pick and roll are we going to see? Do we see more help or doubles against Jocks? I thought Gary Payton the second had a great defensive play late in that game. Not just on the last game winner where he literally saw Ja going to half court and walked with him and pushed him back further. But also when Ja had a drive, I think Curry switched on to him and GP2 had great late help on the spin. And does Ja balance the ability to score with now knowing when the help is coming, kicking? Like, there's just so many questions I want to see game two. And that's the fun. Like, I want to see the next game. I want to see how this develops for both sides. It's good stuff. Also, there's two things I want to fix.
Okay.
Please, please, please. A lot of y'all in polos spend a lot of time watching film, breaking down the game, putting these reports together. If Kevon Looney is on the perimeter, he's doing one thing. If you're guarding Steph Curry, you see Kevon Looney on the wing, please do something and be ready. If you're a big and Kevon Looney is spaced on the perimeter, I know you want to sit back in the paint because he can't shoot. He's not going to. He's setting a screen, and you're going to be flying out at a shooter and putting your arms in the air. We've only seen it for like 9 years. Also, number two. Look, man. And it's three, actually.
Okay.
Mikal Bridges is coming to set a screen. He's slipping. And if Jay Crowder is bringing the ball up for the Phoenix Sun, Devin Booker is flying off something. I don't understand. You think they're going to run pick and roll?
You got any more? Do you want to sprinkle in there?
No, that's it for now.
Okay. Also, quick Otto Porter mention. Why the fuck were you not expecting me to bring up Otto Porter Jr. in the pod?
Thank you for listening to this episode.
Oh, wow. Spot.
We are
wow.
available on all the machines.
All of the machine. All I'm going to say is that Memphis was pretty comfortable helping off of him, and that is not what Golden State signed him for. He's a really good shooter. He took 1-3. If he's not going to take shots, .. They just go more Kuminga at that point.
I see where the bit goes.
What do you mean the bit?
Vouching for the young guy over the veteran. Let me check the page real quick.
It's not even that. It's just like, man, like they were stashing smaller dudes on him. They were helping off of him. And I'm just like, yo, the entire point of bringing Otto Porter Jr. in, so you can't do that. Or at the very least, you can't do the help off thing. But we talked about some of the Porter at the five lineups during the regular season. And how fruitful they were because of the threat that he provides. He just has to be aggressive.
Feel it. So as you progress, and just to give the dunkers just an open view here, because you watch a lot of basketball, you have seen the game at a different level. Do you ever see someone run something in the first half and kind of bookmark it and then see them run it again? The hashtag is Big Agenda. So Kendrick Perkins tweeted 12 hours ago, hell yeah, Draymond Green deserved that flagrant 2 foul yesterday, and here's why. Carry the hell on, ..
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunkers. Just programming note, we are recording late on a Monday night, so we're recording during Suns Mavericks. We are not about to try to piece together some live game analysis on that one. So, we will reconvene on that series on the Friday edition of the show.
I do have a quick thought, though.
Oh, go ahead.
Very quick one, because we're not going to go box score hunting. Also, side note, Maxi Kleber is 5-for-8 from 3. Is he in a contract year? Is he? Can someone look that up real quick as I make my Luka point?
Let me look that up while you make your Luka point. Go ahead.
We're recording during this game. Did catch a little bit. Mikal Bridges' defense on Luka is going to be very important. His ability to navigate screens and recover is huge because part of the pressure for Dallas is Luka being able to lead the dance, and they want to keep Ayton in a drop. Usually Luka can keep his man back, keep attacking, engage the big, and open up the lob or a shot. If Bridges is going to be able to fight back in front and you're taking options off the table for Luka, yeah, there's counters, but it's mainly him scoring. I'm intrigued. He has 32.6 assists. Dallas has 26 made field goals, 12 assists. Not and also, I want to see how immediately they put Chris Paul in action in game 2. But yeah, that's my only takeaway. But yeah, it's not going to work if Luka only has a scoring option in pick and roll and Jalen Brunson can't do things. And if we remember the New Orleans series, they kind of feel confident with their length against certain guards. Put it that way.
That they do. The contract year is next season for Maxi Kleber.
You're trying to get the payment before the payment. I see the vision.
Trying to get that extension midway through next year, I respect it. Or in the offseason, either one. But he's going to have to make those shots. He's going to have to space them out.
Yeah, if 22 made threes in this game, 8 of them come from Maxi Kleber and Jay Crowder. There's your game 1 recap.
Folks, we've done it. We will reconvene later in the week. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We're on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. Please join the Dunker Spot community if you have not already. We have fun. We also host watch parties where there are more bits that do not make the podcast. If you want to get in on those, join the community, have some fun with us. Also, check out the podcast because Mark Jones said so. We will catch y'all later in the week.
Is this a safe space?